the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
I got one.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
In the fall of 2004, United States Marines prepared for what would turn out to be the bloodiest battle of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the Second Battle of Fallujah. During the months preceding the conflict, Fallujah had become a hotbed of insurgent activity, with terrorists and thugs commanding the streets. Enemy fighters had fortified the city in expectation of an eventual confrontation with the Marines. In this episode, Sergeant Jason Arellano of 2nd Platoon, Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, recounts his time in Iraq, including the events preceding the Battle of Fallujah and the intense moments of the battle.
My first deployment to Iraq was for OIF-1, and that was in 2003. I believe we left the States sometime the first week of February, and we went to Kuwait, kind of got acclimated to the temperature out there, and then we went ahead and were one of the first, you know, 1st Marine Division to push into Iraq, and one of our first objectives was the Ramallah oil fields, and we were expected to get some pretty heavy resistance there, and we actually had probably close to 100 Iraqis surrender, so we had to, you know, take them to an assembly area so that they could be questioned and, you know, whatever other stuff was going to go on with him.
On March 20th, 2003, U.S. forces invaded Iraq. Sergeant Arellano's division was one of the first to enter the country. By mid-April, little organized resistance remained.
We continued to push. We were pushing so fast that we were moving well ahead of our food supplies. So after any type of firefight, you know, we were scrounging around and we would often find chickens that we would put in boxes with holes, and once we got to an area that was clear, you know, we would get those chickens out and wring their necks and pluck their feathers and have some roadside chicken. I do remember one instance where we were so hungry that we didn't have any food, where we were actually looking at a dog, and the dog seemed to be chasing something out there in the desert, and it turned out he was chasing a pretty big lizard, so the lizard was easier for us to catch, and a bunch of guys kind of gathered around a little fire, and we broke out all of the little spices and salts that we had left over from our MREs and kind of put together a little spice for it. So I remember eating a lizard out there, and we pushed as far north as Tikrit, and then we came back down and finished off our deployment in a town called Ad-Dawaniya to the south, and we did several patrols through the cities, walked amongst the people. IEDs was something that wasn't even a thought. The first time that we went to Iraq, we were greeted by lots of people who were praising us and praising the United States of America. A lot of people were chanting, Bush, 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 Saddam, no good. So we felt like, you know, what we're doing, we're here and people are being appreciative of what we're doing. We had several, you know, the kids would come up to us. You know, we were able to give them, you know, some candy or some gum from our MREs. I guess from the Arab culture, you know, for the women to come out with something that was kind of unheard of, and there were actually women that were bringing roses to some of the Marines. So I think that our impression of what was going on there was definitely a good thing. You know, these people were under a dictator that, you know, they weren't happy with or pleased with, and they were an oppressed people, so they were very grateful for us to be there. And like I said, you know, walking amongst these the locals there in the marketplaces, an IED or, you know, the thought. I know we always had the security posture of, you know, anything can happen at any time, but we never experienced a grenade being thrown at us as we drove through the marketplace or anything like that. So it was relatively safe. I felt like we went out there, and anybody that did want to fight with us, we either neutralized them or we detained them. And so I think the difference between the first time and the second time was, I mean, a 180-degree turnaround. Now I felt like there were people that were still appreciative that were there. I think they were kind of maybe annoyed or anxious for us to kind of get the job done and go ahead and get out of their country. But there was definitely a presence of people from surrounding countries that were coming in there as mercenaries. And I felt like it was easier for them to cross into Iraq than it was for them to come up with some elaborate plans to come and attack American soil. So if these guys out there, that if they want to kill Americans, hey, there's a bunch of Americans right there in country. You know, it, like, again, like I said, I felt like it was easier for them to go in there, and that's why we were meeting, you know, a variety of people that weren't necessarily Iraqi personnel. I mean, we all knew about the attack that took place earlier in the year by the Marines, and how, you know, they were forced to kind of pull back.
On March 31st, 2004, four American contractors of the Blackwater Private Security Force were ambushed and killed in Fallujah. The U.S. Marines responded by launching Operation Vigilant Resolve on April 4th to take back control of Fallujah from the insurgent forces that had been gaining strength in the city. By April 28th, U.S. forces and the local populace ended the conflict by promising to keep insurgents out of the city.
So we knew that Iraq was definitely becoming an insurgent stronghold. When we first arrived in country into Iraq, you know, we had our briefs and we did several drills on how we were going to react on the convoy should we be attacked. During the convoy, we started to take indirect fire from mortars. It was not very accurate, but I think at that point, I looked around at some of our junior Marines that this was their first deployment, and I remember telling them, you know, welcome to Iraq, like, here we go, like, it's on, you know, and for me, it was a definite reality check that, you know, this was definitely going to be different from the second deployment. And I felt that way just because we've been in country for so long already as a force, and we were still receiving this type of indirect fire. I knew that there was going to be a stronger battle ahead.
Fallujah had been one of the calmer cities in Iraq in the days following the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime. But by April 2004, violence steadily began to rise. Between April and November, the number of insurgent fighters rose from 200 to more than 3,000, many of these dedicated hardcore terrorists from outside of Iraq. On September 24th, a high-ranking U.S. official told ABC News that Fallujah had become the military's highest priority.
Once we got to Camp Fallujah, we were able to talk with other units that had been into the city, you know, that they were getting ready to head back home to the States. So there was definitely a sense of, you know, watch your back out here because, you know, IEDs are now a factor. Vehicle-borne IEDs are a factor. And suicide bombers are a factor. So I think we all knew that we really had to be very, very aware of our surroundings. 360-degree security never meant more to us than it did at that time. At the time, our first mission was going to be to provide security along Route Mobile, being that it was a main, you know, artery for convoys and vehicles coming into Camp Fallujah. So once we kind of got familiar with the area, then the roles changed. Their squad leader then came out with my squad and I, and they would kind of shadow us, and then the turnover took place. I believe the first time that I went out with them, we were in a convoy and they were trying to stop a vehicle and the vehicle wouldn't stop, and they shot the vehicle to kind of warn the guy to stop. The guy kept on coming and then they eventually shot him dead. And I remember going back that evening to my guys and telling them, like, this is a whole new ballgame, guys. Like, I watched them kill a guy today. The vehicles, you know, the rules of engagement were, you know, guys got a weapon, you know, if it's pointed at you, then you can shoot at them. It was very, very different from the first time where anybody, they didn't even have to have a weapon in their hand. As long as they were wearing a uniform, they were game. So now it was a lot different because they had to literally be shooting at you, is what it seemed like for a lot of these rules of engagement. So I always told the guys, you got to be on top of it, because if you see a guy pointing a weapon at you and he's starting to shoot, you need to take him out immediately, because if he drops that weapon, you know, per the rules of engagement, we're supposed to not engage the person. So it was very frustrating. But once we did the relief in place and we went out, I believe there was a squad that was going out to one of the posts, and they were hit by an IED. And there was actually still Marines from the company that we were relieving. And that's when Kilo Company started to take their first casualty. Myself and Sergeant Navarro of 1st Platoon were inside the company office at Camp Bajaria, and we could hear the radio start to go off. They were starting to call in that they were under contact and that they were, repelling the enemy. They were shooting back and that they had people that needed to be medevaced.
When we return, Sergeant Arellano discusses how he responded when the battle intensified. Stay tuned.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, now online at radioamerica.org.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Before we left, Sergeant Jason Arellano's squad met heavy fire from insurgent forces, leaving several of his Marines wounded. And this battle was far from over.
So myself and Sergeant Navarro wanted to form a squad to go out, really a hasty react squad, just to go out there and help them out. Our first sergeant and company commander told us to go ahead and meet them at Camp Fallujah's trauma unit. And so by the time that we were able to get together over there, they were already taking the people being medevaced into the trauma center there. So we didn't actually see them, but myself and Sergeant Navarro and a few other Marines had to clean out the Humvee, which I also won't forget. We were pulling flesh out of this Marine's gear, literally, you know, chunks of meat. So that was pretty tough. We later found out that one of our Marines took a pretty big piece of shrapnel to his leg, and they feared that he might lose his leg, and, you know, they feared that he might also not make it. But come November, you know, we really started to talk about our plans to go in there. There were several orders that were briefed to us, and the training that was going on in Camp Bajaria was just for the mount environment. We were linking up with our tank commanders and any vehicle drivers of the amphibious assault vehicles. So we were becoming familiar with who was going to be assigned with us.
During the early morning hours of November 8th, U.S. Army and Marine Corps forces initiated the battle with an intense bombing and an attack on the main train station. This was used as a staging point for reinforcement troops. Navy Seabees followed up to clear the street of debris from the bombardments.
The sense, once we took our first objective, which was the apartments just to the northwest of the city, we didn't take too much resistance there at all. I think we actually had a few people surrender, people that were kind of hesitant to leave, you know, despite the warning. So we were dealing with civilians at that point. We didn't push into the city till the next day, which I believe was November 7th or 8th. And from the apartment complex, we were able to look over the railroad tracks that headed east to west between us and the city. We had our machine gunners engaging, you know, key targets on that first block of the city. We could see planes flying overhead, dropping bombs into the city. Helicopters were flying over our Cobras, and they were engaging targets. And we had some tanks lined up along the streets. As we pushed underneath the bridge into the city of Fallujah, once we got into our first staging area, there was almost an eerie silence, if you will, the silence before the storm. It was about to happen. It didn't seem like there was anybody in it because we had pounded the first block or two. And once we kind of got an eyes on of our first block that my squad was going to be responsible for, the adrenaline rush was so intense that, you know, we were kicking in doors, jumping over buildings, really doing stuff that was really remarkable. And I really think it was just the adrenaline that was going on. And it wasn't until we got a few blocks into the city that we started to actually see, you know, dead insurgents laying in the streets. So now the stench of, you know, death was there, but it was just something that, you know, we just had to block out and kind of just got used to it. We would see cats and dogs running around the city. Initially, you know, they were skinny. And as we got further into the city and as time progressed, these cats and these dogs became very fat from having their bellies full. They were eating the dead bodies. And we would actually see, you know, the dogs, you know, fighting over a leg and a cat sticking its head inside an insurgent's head because he had half of it blown off. So that was something that was, you know, if you've got a weak stomach, I'm sure some of the guys were kind of, they might have gotten nauseous about it, but I mean, really it was just jump over that body and go into the next building type of deal. So the city of Fallujah was just, it was really trashy, and it smelled like death. Death was in the air. I really felt like the outskirts of the city had your, you know, teenager scrubs that did not really know how to fight. They were given a weapon and they were told to point and shoot. So those guys were not a problem to us. We were able to deal with them very easily. But as we got further and further into the city, I definitely saw a more well-trained fighter that obviously knew the city better than we did because they definitely used the alleyways to their advantage. Their tactics were very military-like. I feel like they also had a couple of years to see us out there on how we reacted to IEDs or contact. They knew that we pulled our vehicles off to the side. That's where a lot of the IEDs started to be placed. So I really feel like they were adapting to how we were reacting to what they were doing to us. And they were using that in their favor.
Coming up, Sergeant Arellano reveals the drastic means to which the insurgents would go in order to gain an edge against the Marines.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. We return now to the story of Sergeant Jason Arellano, who fought with the United States Marine Corps in Fallujah. Arellano and his fellow Marines faced a determined enemy in Fallujah, one that often resorted to using various drugs in an attempt to gain an edge. Here, Arellano describes the frustration that led to for U.S. forces.
But in just about every house that we did have contact or fight insurgents, or we saw insurgents, we would find needles. Some of the docs would point out some little vials that they said, you know, was a type of drug that would cause adrenaline rush. So we sometimes would have to empty magazines into these little guys just to knock them down, which was very frustrating to us because we were going through a lot of ammunition trying to knock these guys down. And it could be scary, you know. You shoot a guy and he keeps on coming at you. It's, you know, you need to make your shots count. I did have an Army Ranger. There was, a fire team that got attached with us for some reason. And I was telling him my frustration about how we couldn't knock these guys down. And he was kind enough to give me about two magazines worth of hollow points and one of our next firefights. Those hollow points proved to be a lot better than our 5.56 regular rounds. I do believe that the drug factor was there. December 12th, we started pushing from the western side of the city to the eastern side of the city because we were going to do a relief in place for another unit in that area. And at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Millay wanted us to go ahead and do a sweep of the homes just because he knew that the other units were not necessarily doing the squeegee tactics that we were doing, where we were clearing every single house. We pushed up into the school area, and at that point, myself and the other squad leaders of the platoon, along with our platoon commander, went to the rooftop to set up our security, or at least talk about how we were going to set up our security. And I remember being on top of this rooftop, and the sandbags were only stacked a few high. You almost had to be in a prone position to be on this rooftop and have some type of cover. So I kept a real low silhouette, not knowing the area, and knowing that I didn't want to get taken out by a sniper at this point. We started to hear gunfire coming from our south, in this 915 block, which was, I want to say, 3rd Platoon. They were starting to clear that area when they started taking contact. I told my squad leaders that were with me and the other, the platoon commander, that was our men in contact because our guys went down there to help them out. So I jumped off, went down the stairs, jumped out of that building, and started to run towards the 915 block. At this time, there was a convoy of Humvees, amphibious assault vehicles, and I'm not sure if there was a tank in there as well. They were heading to the school so that they could all come in there and get set up as well. And so I was pointing at these vehicles to turn around because there was a firefight that was going on right behind them. So a few of those vehicles turned around. But as I got to that corner block, I was able to look to the west, and I saw a Marine laying on the street, and he had already been shot. And so I kind of shouted at him and went ahead and started running in his direction at the same time. And it was one of the Marines from our platoon. So I asked him, you know, hey, what's going on? Like, are you good? Like, what's the situation? He was conscious enough to tell me, you know, yes, I've been shot, but there's people inside the house. And I could just see that he was conscious and he was able to kind of drag himself to the side. So I went ahead and just pushed into this house. The house that I'm talking about is a house that Corporal Stewart was killed in. He was on the second floor, and the Marines were trying to get to his body. I believe at the time he was actually still alive, but was pulled into the room, and the insurgents were kind of shooting him in places where he was not dying. They were shooting him just to torture him, is what I've understood to hear. Once I saw what was going on there in the bottom deck, it seemed like there was enough Marines. So I went ahead and pushed out of there and went into the next building to the east. That building had already been cleared. We went up to the second deck onto the patio, and that's where I linked up with my platoon commander. And I believe Captain McNulty also arrived there, and they were just, you know, trying to figure out the situation, what was going on. By this time, Marines were swarming into every building in that block. The building just to the east of the one that I was on now with the patio, Staff Sergeant Blazer had now been killed on the staircase, and they were trying to get that house cleared. My lieutenant told me to go ahead and go and clear that building because they pulled all the Marines out after they evacuated Staff Sergeant Blazer. I was able to assemble a quick little squad, and I had two of my team leaders with me, Lance Corporal Fernandez and Corporal Leonard. We went out. Before we made entry into this house, I believe we were told, you know, that Staff Sergeant Blazer had just been killed, so we knew that there were insurgents in there. Prior to making entry, I went ahead and looked around at the whole surrounding area, and I saw a CAT vehicle with a Mark 19 mounted on it. And I went ahead and pulled the Marines away from that house and ran up to the CAT vehicle, told the gunner to start laying into that house. So he fired about, I don't know, 10 rounds of Mark 19 into the 40 millimeter grenade. My lieutenant did not know that I was ordering this from the CAT vehicle, so he thought that I had already made entry and that the vehicles were now shooting at us. So a ceasefire was called, but by this time, myself and the other Marines were already following in trail of the Mark 19 rounds hitting the house. So we made entry into the bottom deck. We threw grenades just about into every room down there, cleared out the first deck. A Marine came in and told us that they saw some insurgents upstairs, and again, I believe they told us that Staff Sergeant Blazer had been killed on the staircase. I went ahead and took point, moved up the staircase, and whipped around, did a 180, and started securing the top deck. At this time, another Marine pulled a grenade and threw it onto the second deck. We took cover. We let that blow up. And then myself and another Marine went ahead and started to push up the staircase. As I pushed up the staircase, I had a room to my direct right with an open door, and I had a room to my direct front with an open door. So I wanted to go ahead and just take the path of least resistance. I had to run past the open door on the right, which normally we wouldn't run past an open door. I just felt like, you know, the path of least resistance was the best at this point. And so myself and the other Marine ran into this room. We shot into the corner. I shot into the bed. I shot into the stand-up closets that they had in a lot of these homes. We knew that insurgents tended to sometimes hide in those closets. So I shot all those areas, and the room was called clear. And I turned around, and I could see the Marines forming a train on the staircase. And so the open door to my right initially was now between myself and the Marines on the staircase. So I was able to look at this open door to my left now as I looked at the Marines. I went ahead and got a grenade ready, pulled the pin, and I was getting ready to throw it into the room. At that point, the point man of the train from the staircase, he broke off and he was going to run into my room. So I made way for him, still holding my grenade, and he threw a grenade into the room to his right as he ran into my room. So I had a couple options. You know, I could hold on tight to my grenade and hope that the spoon doesn't come loose, or I can go ahead and throw mine in the room as well. So I threw my grenade into that room. There's now two grenades in this room. We took cover for the first blast, and the way that we have trained is once a grenade goes off in a room, you charge into that room so that you can catch these guys disoriented, unconscious, whatever, and finish off clearing that room. So the first grenade goes off, and in my mind, I'm thinking these Marines have no idea of the second grenade. They're going to start to make entry into this room, and they're going to enter a room with a live grenade. So I ran as quickly as possible to my doorway, and I told the Marines, you know, get back, there's another grenade, because they were doing exactly what I thought. They were getting ready to make entry into that room. They were all able to jump back down the staircase into that first landing. From talking to one of my Marines the other day, he told me that he actually saw the grenade roll out into the hallway. I was able to warn them just enough and then tried to start to turn around to get into my room, and the grenade went off. At the same time, the insurgents that were inside the room began to fire out of the doorway. First grenade got them startled, and they started to just shoot out the door. So I was actually hit with the grenade, and the doctors never gave me a clear answer or not, but they felt like I was also shot at the same time. I could barely hear what was going on around me. I think I was deafened for a short period of time there from the grenade. I was trying to yell to the Marines in my room that I was hit. I could still hear gunfire going on, so I believe the Marines from the staircase got themselves back up and went in and started finishing off that room. But I was telling the Marine next to me, I'm hit. And all I could hear was just a soft whisper, you know, repeating the same thing, I'm hit. And the Marine with me, I guess he felt like I just got knocked into the room, or I fell into the room, and he told me, no, you're good to go. And at this point, I was able to take off my neck protector, and blood was shooting out from my neck. And so I was now kneeling and in a pool of my own blood. And so I looked over at the Marine, and I told him, you know, what do you mean I'm good? You know, can't you see I'm bleeding to death? And at the same time, I knew that the mission was what had to be accomplished, and then the troop welfare could follow. So I kind of just laid there and just waited for, you know, somebody to come and get me out of there. So I started to kind of loosen up my flak jacket because I knew that I would eventually have to be looked at there. At that time, I was picked up and whisked away to an amphibious assault vehicle that was waiting for medevac. I was laid on the center bench, and I was in that vehicle with probably about a half dozen other Marines that were injured with, you know, shrapnel. I don't know if there was any guys that were shot up, but, you know, it was a hurting vehicle. I remember telling the corpsman to stop giving me morphine because I wanted to feel some pain. I felt like if I didn't feel any pain, that I was likely to just go ahead and just slip away and not look back. So I told him to stop giving me morphine. And I had a cross on my dog tags, and I grabbed my cross, and I kind of just held him. And the hatch was open on the top of the vehicle, so I was able to look out at the sky. And I remember saying a short little prayer and just telling the Lord, you know, if this is it, if this is the way I'm supposed to go, you know, I'm ready. I knew that it would be hard for my family to accept me passing away like that, but I knew that they would be proud of me because I was proud of being a Marine. So I could hear the chatter coming over the radio that I was the first one to get it taken out of the vehicle, and that just kind of made it more clear to me that I was injured pretty bad. Once we got to Camp Fallujah, which seemed like an eternity, I was pulled out of the vehicle. They began to do a series of tests on me, and shortly thereafter, I went under and was taken into surgery.
When we return, after averting disaster during the grenade attack, Sergeant Arellano faces a new obstacle.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are. Through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast. Now online at radioamerica.org.
This is Tim Hobart from the American Veterans Center. The mission of the center is to provide an opportunity for America's servicemen and women of every generation to share their stories of valor. It also seeks to pass on the legacy of our veterans and military personnel to younger generations, teaching them the value of service and sacrifice. As part of this program, we are inviting our interns for this summer to step in and serve as hosts of an episode of Profiles in Valor. This week's host is Katie Dempsey.
Welcome back to Profiles in Valor. This week, we're joined by two-time Bronze Star recipient, Lieutenant Colonel Maria Kelly of the Army National Guard.
I've served in the military for 26 years, and that's been both the active Army, Army Reserves, and most of my career in the Ohio National Guard.
What caused you to want to join?
Well, I joined a while ago, so my motives are going to probably seem a lot different to people that are joining today, but I was the fourth of 11 children, and basically, you know, my decision to join the military was kind of my ticket out of the house and to see the world and to get an education. And I did all those things. Obviously, I'm still here, and I'm here for different reasons because I love serving my country, and I truly love serving others, especially soldiers and their families.
And was there a specific reason why you switched from the Army to the National Guard?
Well, to be honest, I did not know very much about the National Guard. Really, I didn't know anything when I enlisted out of high school. And if I had, you know, I may have never gone on active duty, but I'm glad that I did. It was certainly, you know, good for me and my family. But when I learned about the Ohio National Guard, I joined, and I have just loved it to this day.
So you deployed to Kuwait in 2003 as plans officer, is that correct?
Yes.
What were your specific jobs at that time?
Well, my responsibilities typically would have been kind of forward-thinking operations, but at that time, mainly my focus was on our activity of the day, and that was getting supplies and equipment from the Kuwaiti port to all points north and that included northern Iraq and western Iraq. You might remember back in 2003, we didn't have the northern port of entry in Turkey, so which was expected. And so we had to kind of shift and now have a sort of a backlog of things in the south to get to far distances north. So transportation was a huge part of my command's responsibility. And as things really started to get a little bit more hostile in the months of June and July is when we really kicked off with a need or demand to have a lot more force protection. And that included equipment and it included training. Specifically, we developed and conducted a convoy live fire exercise that all of our transportation companies, I think we had 17 at the time, would participate in.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that training?
Sure. Well, the purpose for the training was to combat an evolving threat. And I'll just refer to it as a threat, not necessarily an enemy, because for truck drivers, during that time, it was everything from, you know, criminal, maybe a common thief who just is trying to take your water or your valuables or your food that are on the back of the truck because they're thirsty and hungry. So, you know, how you respond or escalate to that type of enemy is probably going to be a little bit different. And it's very complicated. It involves a lot of training, and it involved training that we hadn't necessarily conducted up to that point because, you know, when we prepared to go to war, you prepare for a uniformed enemy. And this particular threat was a little bit more complex than that. And additionally, with logistical convoys, especially, you know, the larger ones that we participated in, because we're talking, you know, mainly tractor trailers and that are taking supplies and heavy equipment forward, you know, the mobility of those trucks is just not that great. You know, they can only respond in certain ways. And so the tactics that a logistical convoy employs are going to be different than, you know, a combat patrol. So just developing those tactics and making do with the equipment that we had at that time, you know, in 2003 and 2004, which was a lot less protective than it is today, those were our challenges. And they were great challenges to grapple with because the ingenuity of the American soldier just never ceases to amaze me. I mean, they will make do with everything that they can and you know, just to get the job done.
Right. And that's still used in combat today, isn't it?
Absolutely. It surely is. But with the things that I was involved in then and the things that I see our soldiers involved in today with regard to the convoys, the practices are a little bit different, obviously, and the equipment is a lot different, which affects the practices. So, you know, we see the MRAPs out there now, and we see the combat platforms that have a lot more levels of armor protection on them than they did when we had the old, you know, soft-side Humvees that we were basically back then using plywood, sandbags, scraps of metal, you know, anything that we could mount on to the vehicles. So, you know, those were our challenges back in the early days. And in later days, you know, you're right, we still grapple with some of the changing tactics and so forth. There is a great constant, you know, and that is the great leadership in the Army today, you know, at all levels. We just have tremendous initiative being shown by very junior soldiers who have to make, you know, major decisions, life and death decisions on a regular basis. And, you know, when they're trained, they do fabulous at that.
Right. I think everyone would agree with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And did you receive a Bronze Star for your work on developing that technique?
The training, yes, that was a part of the Bronze Star medal that I received in 2003.
When did you receive your other medal?
It was 2007, and that was after a deployment to northern Iraq.
And what was the situation surrounding that award?
My responsibilities then, I deployed as commander of a forward support battalion headquarters. Actually, I took about maybe a third of my headquarters alone. We were basically an organization designed at that time to support a brigade combat team, but we were deployed to basically provide base operations, which included base defense and base support operations and, you know, the associated force protection on the bases. We did that with two adjoining bases in northern Iraq. And, just a very tremendous opportunity to learn and grow, I guess you would say, because it was kind of outside of our scope of what we had been exposed to. We were a brigade-level asset back then, which means, you know, we knew how to support Army and other green uniforms, and now we were being asked to support, you know, many different civilians from various agencies, contractors, subcontractors, non-governmental agencies, anyone that basically lived or operated on our bases. We provided support and protection for those persons.
Was that your biggest challenge, would you say?
I would say it definitely was. Just the complexities of it. It was just wonderful how people work together, you know, when they have a common cause like that. But, you know, I mean, that wasn't necessarily my background in the past, and so it took some real growing for me. Now, you know, I had been exposed to that a little bit. My command had some base responsibilities in 2003 and 2004, so I kind of had an idea of what we were in for, and it made it possible for me to kind of line up a group of soldiers, you know, to fill the ranks when we would deploy that had some of that background. My XO, who also was the mayor of the FOBs, he had a very extensive background, still does, in contracting on the civilian side. So he had those credentials and that experience, and you know, that was just a great asset to have. And, you know, I was able to take with me also soldiers that had, you know, just great experience in base defense operations and combat arms that, you know, just allowed me to have a lot of good assurance and a lot of good skill sets to draw from while we were there, because we were a pretty small team of people for such large responsibilities.
Did you have to use them a lot? Was there a lot of activity on your base?
Well, we were, you know, adjacent to Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, and so, yes, I would say we were constantly engaging in those defensive activities. You know, our goal was to maintain a very hardened posture, you know, a posture that would deter anyone from, you know, taking the time to think that they could get anywhere with us. But what was in the back of everyone's mind really was, and I just left theater in 2004, just a couple months before the FOB had been penetrated by a suicide bomber who walked into the dining facility and detonated himself during the lunch hour. And, you know, that was on our minds very heavily. It was just a horrible thing, you know, to have happened, because there was a lot of progress in that area prior to that. And, you know, when I found out that base was going to be where we would be and that would be our responsibility to protect it, I, you know, was very concerned about both the outward defense of the base as well as anything that might penetrate inwardly and hurt soldiers. Our goal was to have a safe environment so that the warfighters could conduct their mission and come back and not have to worry about their safety, but they could recover and be ready for the next mission. So that was a constant process, and to keep from getting comfortable or complacent in those operations, that was always a challenge too.
Right. So what are you up to now? Are you
Well, I just, a couple projects? Of days ago, I finished a tour as Rear Detachment Commander for Sustainment Brigade Headquarters. When I returned, this particular brigade headquarters was heading over to Multinational Division West, and they just returned a few months ago, and I've just handed that back over to the commander. So today I'm actually just having a little bit of a release and a waiting assignment.
And now you're interviewing.
That's right.
Are those your kids in the background?
Yes.
Okay. That leads me to my next question. Well, I imagine it's very difficult balancing being an officer, a wife, and a mother. How do you do that? What would be your words of advice for other female soldiers that hope to accomplish all that you have?
Well, I would say planning is obviously a huge part of any successes that we've had, and it works the other way too. Lack of planning really will hurt. But, you know, really my advice would be just hang in there, because for my husband and I both, you know, over the years there have been points in our lives, and there's always a point when, you know, maybe a child is born or someone gets a new job or whatever, that it just, it becomes overwhelming, and you think to yourself, yeah, it's time for one of us to let this go, or, you know, both of us, or whatever. And, you know, in my career, I could probably pinpoint maybe 5 or 6 times when, you know, I've almost put the papers in and gone. And I would just say hang in there, because if it weren't for some key leaders, supervisors, colleagues in my life, you know, I probably would be gone for now. But they helped me to see that these are just temporary times in our lives, and that there's, you know, great rewards ahead if you just continue to grow and to learn and to contribute.
We've been speaking with 2-time Bronze Star recipient Lieutenant Colonel Maria Kelly of the U.S. Army National Guard.
Profiles in Valor is produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. To hear more profiles, subscribe on iTunes or visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.